Session number 7363.
Mr. Jameson, tape 6. You were going to explain your first experience of sort of wounding and
yes,
death.
We were in. we'd probed up towards the Menin Road on this patrol I told you about, and then we'd retired, and our infantry had spread out in the fields and were busy digging in, and gradually that line began to be settled into pockets of resistance, you see, and defence. Later, I suppose it would link up as a thorough trench, and then the work would be going on of actually making that trench a solid job and revetting it and whatnot, with odd points posted along it, which would be strong points, redoubts of sorts. But while that, once we'd come back and the infantry had taken over and were resisting the German attack, and the Germans weren't getting anywhere, they were shelling us like nobody's business. First of all, that I told you, Gelleveld was decimated, and then Hooge, which was a headquarters. Hooge was getting it. Hooge had been taken over by the divisional people as a headquarters. We were standing by in this wood on the side of the road. We didn't know what we were going to do or what we were going to have to do, simply waiting there. That was an awful lot of war, waiting. And while we were in there, of course, the Germans were shelling all around the place, and there was a lot of shrapnel flying around. And as I say, my old horse, we called Donaghy, we had wallets on the front of the saddle to carry gear in, and we had a rolled over coat on the back of the saddle wrapped up, and the shell fire that did it, we were sort of dodging and hiding behind trees and trying to take cover, and we were wondering what was going to happen next. And various people got hit, not seriously, just odd wounded people, and bits of splinters flying around. And one of these fellows, an infant, there was a leaf going up, and one of these fellows asked me for a light, and I struck a match and held it out to him, and as I held that out to him, he just dropped. And that was about the first thing I can recollect of anybody suddenly passing out of existence.
Were you shocked by that?
Yeah. Yes. I was conscious of being scared stiff, wondering when I'd cop it next, and seeing other people being hit. Really the first experience of being close to the sharp end of the job, so to speak. And after the sporadic shelling shifted a bit from us and began to look around, I found that the canvas water bucket that I used to carry over the hilt of the sword had holes right through it with bits. I had to get something else, string on, to tie the top coat back in again. That was split. The horse had a slice right down his side and his ribs, just as though someone had taken a red hot poker and done that with it. And I thought, well, you'll get over that. If that had hit me, I shouldn't have been here. And that sort of situation was what we were gradually becoming involved in. And yet, one very quickly developed the sort of feeling, well, this is war. It can happen to anybody. Thank God it hasn't been me. And that was about all. In a situation where you didn't know where the next one was coming, you're pretty well scared stiff and look for somewhere to get your head down. I only knew one man, personally, that I would say was completely without fear. Only one. I believe there were others. Probably. If they had fear, they never showed it. General Cotton, who came and found me in the OP up at Newport, for instance, in a foggy morning the first day of our arrival, and the Jerry's had gas attacked the place and we had to be rushed in instead of being on rest. General Cotton came up there and he was just without any fear whatsoever, but how far that went, I don't know, because I didn't even know he was General Cotton until his bloke behind told me, that's the general you've been talking to, you know. All he had was a Macintosh and a hat on. He said, well, can't see anything from here this morning, Gunner. Fog's too thick. I said, yes. I thought of took in his general face, yes, sir. but I didn't know who he was. I said, it's a bit unfortunate coming up here the first day and I can't even see the other side of the river. I don't even know what I might be looking at. And he said, well, I'm sorry, I could have shown you all that if the weather had been decent, because I know this area pretty well. And that the bloke behind me told me, also, said, that's the general, divisional general that you're talking to there. I said, nice bloke, isn't he?
Were many like that?
Oh, yes, yes.
Were they, the generals, yes. Approachable?
Yes. Some weren't and some were. As gunner officers being sent up later, we were all sent up to battalions to take their instructions or requests or whatever as to what sort of artillery fire or what sort of thing they needed blowing up, you see. And it was a regular job to go as an FOO to battalion. When an attack was on, you went over with them, you see. But during the holding the line thing, you went up and you went along with their intelligence officer, and he would point out the various strong points there were, and can you do anything about that, or could you do a bit about this for us, or there's a bit of trouble over there, you might. We used to make all these things and then sit down with the field glasses are on there that I used, with a graticule in the eye as well, bit old ancient now. You would sit up there, you would get onto the battery and you would say, map reference so-and-so, get ready, we're going to shoot up this place, you see, and just conversationally describe what was going to be happening, and then let me know when you're ready. And we'd sit meanwhile talking to the IO about how things were and what was life like and so forth, and generally just pass the time of day. And then suddenly the telephonist would come on and say, all ready for you now, sir, and right off we go, and you'd start shooting. That was the general sort of thing that happened. But in an attack, when you were attached to them like that, your main job was to keep them supplied with firepower and to try and find out where that firepower, once the actual barrages had gone and jumped and gone on, you had so much firepower that was freed to take on targets for them, special targets, not just curtain fire. So you'd be tacked onto company or whatever and get to know what was going on and be following this up and shooting things up for them. Generally looking after your skin at the same time, because it wasn't just walking over comfortable peacetime ground, you know, things were happening. But our role then, as gunner officers, our role then was to support the infantry and to have close liaison with them, and for the subalterns to be with the infantry on a rota basis all the time, 24-hour reliefs, keeping that going all the time so that we could get all the information from them we could to fire as much, make their job as easy as possible. Now, some of the people you went to were marvellous and some were not. And I can remember we'd been supplied with a lot of American ammunition and it wasn't at all good. The shell is rather, as you know, it's rather like that siphon there, and it has a curved top. And they had made that curved top too thin so that when the things were fired, the rotation of the fuse, which was a heavy brass job and you could rotate to put your timing on it, the torsion of that on this narrowed skin of the shell was so much that they ripped them off. So once they went away from the guns after about 1,000 yards, these things were whipped off and then the shells would just go whoop up and come into the ground. Although we were supporting the Grenadiers and the Coldstreams at that on that front, and unfortunately for us, the bloke in command of the Grenadiers was Lascelles, later Lord Harwood. A nasty piece of work. He was a Grenadier Guards officer. He'd been chucked out of the Leicester Square theatre, times out of number, being tight and wrecking the place and whatnot in peacetime. You know, he was a real tearaway. As a colonel commanding a battalion, he was like the Almighty. When I was posted up to him for a 7-day stretch, you report to the battalion commander, and he'd normally pass you over to his IO, and you would then study maps, and he would tell you what was going on and what he would like you to do, and then you'd go for a walk around, get into the front line and go and look at these things. Well, Lascelles sat in this dugout, which I suppose wasn't any further down below the ground than perhaps half as high as this room, and a table got up with ammunition boxes, and he was sitting at one end, and just ordering people about, you see, and telling them things. There was no comfort about the look of it at all. There's no ease in it. Everybody sort of jumped yes or no, sir, and when they came in, saluted them before they said anything, all that sort of stuff. We weren't a bit popular because we fired a lot of these American shells, and he didn't think we thought we were making a muck of him, because they were dropping around his headquarters. But we went off and hunted round and found a lot and sent them back to division, and they stopped the supply of them straight away. Now, having a week with him was very uncomfortable. You were on the jump the whole time. The IO was just as scared of him as anybody else, and it wasn't a sort of comradely sort of show at all. But after us back with the battery again, sent up for another week to the adjoining Coldstreams, and Viscount Gort was commanding there. And the first thing as I blew into his dugout was, "Come in, Gunner, I'm going to scare the pants off you tomorrow." This was the evening I'd got up there, you see. I hope you're an early riser. I'm getting you out first thing in the morning. I'm going to show you a few things. See what you're made of. Now, he was a different man altogether.
Did that make a difference to your attitude?
Oh, yes. I mean, he was outgoing, you see. You felt, well, I'll give this fellow everything I've got, you know. The other man, you sort of do what is necessary to just keep him quiet and keep out of his way. But not cooperative in the same way. But Gort took me off the next morning, and he did scare the pants off me, because he was a fellow who didn't seem to fear anything very much.
Did you ever see any of the high-ups, Haig or Plumer?
Yes. Bench? Oh, yes. They used to come and inspect us, you know. The divisions or the brigades were... That was not the people in the line, but the people just behind. They would go off on their own with a party to... I was the youngest corporal in the yeomanry when I was in there, and... I had a very good section, and very shortly afterwards the brigadiers and the generals asked for gallopers to be added to their staff, you see, to escort them here, there and everywhere. And my section, General Watts was our divisional general, my section was taken from me. And the senior corporal in the squadron was given command of it, and they went off to division as escort. So these two fellows, Philip Ridley and Keith Ridley and Les Wood, were taken and went to division as gallopers. They had a marvellous time, you see, and Tommy Blair, who was a West Country farmer, he was the senior corporal. He got command of my section. I was fed up with that. thought I should have gone.
What did you think of the generals when you saw them? Haig, for instance.
They were a bit remote, you know. Well, I suppose we blamed them unfairly about some things. We might blame them quite fairly about other things, but generally speaking, they were rather remote. The only people, the only generals that we really ran up against were the brigade commanders. I think it was when Neuve Chapelle was on, General Sir Sidney Lawford, popularly called Flash Alf, he commanded the 20th Brigade, and we happened to be, I with a few other fellows, happened to be just alongside his dugout on the Rue de Bois, where he'd come out and perched a mirror on the sandbags at the side while he did his hair up and shaved and whatnot, you know. He was absolutely immaculate. He's quite rightly called Flash Alf, but a good general. I think we were very well served with the generals in the 7th Division. I can't remember the names now, but I can remember meeting them at different times and different places, and they were all over the front, you know. They weren't backroom soldiers at all. In one place I remember one of the generals was killed because he'd got himself too near the front. They were right up. If there was something to be done, they would go and have a good look-see. Generally speaking, I think we were, as far as my experience was concerned, we were pretty well served. I can't say the same about we had good troop officers in the A squadron. But the commander of the squadron was a Major Burrell, and we called him Fanny. If there was anything going on, he wasn't there. Colin Lang, who was a marvellous horseman, commanded number 4 troop. Eustace Smith, Philip Eustace Smith, was our commander in 2 troop. There was another fellow commanding, I can't remember his name, but I can picture him commanding number 1 troop, and his brother was in number 3 as a trooper. They were very good. They were very courageous fellows, and eventually, of course, they were promoted with red tabs to be ADCs to generals. After our role became more like an infantry, which happened after I'd left.
What were you doing between Neuve Chapelle in March and Loos in September?
Oh, just doing certain spells in the trenches, certain spells in the back areas. Filling time in, you might almost say, not doing anything very much. Regular sort of duties of one sort or another. Sometimes relieving the front line, sometimes playing around in the rear or being given jobs of some sort, digging support trenches, carrying stuff. And before Loos, of course, as I told you, carrying up these gas bottles. Now, there was a stupidity of somebody. You would have thought it would have been only common sense to realize that if you're going to use gas, you've got to be very sure that the wind is going to blow in the right direction. Well, now, they didn't. They got all these bottles, slogging up, carrying these damn things up into the trenches, wiggling them around. A gas bottle like those oxygen cylinders, you know, that sort of thing.
About 3 foot high.
Iron things, and very heavy and very awkward. And we laboriously toted these things up into the front line and stacked them in traverses along the front line, ready to be used when the attack was opened. Well, I know that some of the fellows in the front, or in the regimental officers, reported that the wind was in the wrong direction for use of this, and this was disregarded. Why? God alone knows. But the fact remains that they did release that gas in the Loos attack, and a lot of our people got their own stuff. Definitely the wind was in the wrong direction. I've noted in reading other reading accounts in different places that that is stressed, that that using that gas was just plain crass stupidity. It should never have been opened up at all. All right, they carried it there, all right, it was a wasted exercise, but to use it in the wrong conditions. Now, eventually, of course, the German perfected the idea of gas shell, which were, they would saturate an area with it. Very correctly, too. I mean, they would pick out places they couldn't shell very adequately, where approach roads would be used for bringing up rations and carrier parties and reinforcements and whatnot, and they would just saturate that area with gas shells. I can remember one day, a beautiful fine day, and Drew Common and I, when two telephonists were walking back from the front, and he was a very whimsical sort of fellow, and we'd got into an area where they had been trying to cut a few trenches, and they were no deeper than this, and we were sitting on the edge of this while he filled his pipe, and discussing something about the front line or what we'd been doing, I forget what, but suddenly one of our telephonists, suddenly one of our telephonists where a trench had V'd out, he'd been perched on this fork, suddenly leapt into the air and ran away screaming blue murder. It was dampish. We went and wondered what the devil had happened to him. We went and examined the place where he was sitting and found a gas shell had gone in there and had buried itself and seeped out gradually. The liquid had got into the earth with the damp, and he was burned. He had to be taken off to hospital, all the skin taken off him. But at the time it was funny. Not for him.
How soon were you equipped with gas masks?
Oh, right at the beginning. Well, very early. The first gas mask we had were bits of grey army shirt with a rubber tube, sort of thing, like one of these things you make noises with, you know, that sort of thing, stuck out here. And you had to stick it inside your jacket and button the thing round. Goggles. That was all. Very uncomfortable. You couldn't breathe through this thing very well. Gradually, that became a little bit more improved, the mouthpiece, the breathing apparatus, and then they used to tell us in order to get the eyes clear, there were pockets in the side. You could poke your finger in the stuff and do this, you see, to get the fog off your goggles. I'm trying to think when we got to the... Eventually we got to the thing on the chest that you hitched round, hitched it up, and then put the tape around here and tied it on, pulled the thing out and stuck that on. On occasions we've fired a complete barrage, all the battery wearing gas masks, you know. Not comfortable at all. And the Germans, I thought they were better. They had a rubber mask, no bag of any sort. They had a rubber mask and huge goggles, and on here, a large sort of canister, which they could just do that, and it was on, and do that, and it was off, so that they could breathe perfectly as long as this thing was going, and be very comfortable and not encumbered by a whole lot of gear. And then if it happened to run out, they'd just whip that off, pick another canister and put that on, and they're away again with all the filtering stuff. We thought the German gas masks were good.
Were yours ever as good throughout the war?
I don't think they were ever as good as the Germans, for two reasons. That the Germans was effective. You could replace the filtering thing by another as soon as that wore out. And you had no encumbrance anywhere else. And that was one of the great things about it. Not to be encumbered with a whole lot of stuff. I think there's a picture in that book somewhere of me with one of these things stuck on my chest. Well, you know, all that to get all that gear on and to have to fasten it all, whereas with a mask you just pushed it on and there it was. Much better German idea.
Yes, they sound more like the Second World War civilian masks,
yes.
Don't they?
Yes. And you see the German telephones, again, there was another feature. We had these boxes with the batteries in and the Morse key mounted on the side of it and a pair of headphones, and you put that in, you're coupled up, and you could talk with this thing. Or down it if you could use the headphones and the mouthpiece all right. The German had a very small thing, and it was a rather like the new handset. It was a large handset that had all the stuff in here. You see, and I remember getting into a dugout and finding one of these things. I said, "Hey, can I have a look at this? Look at this cherry thing. All you do is fasten that onto your batteries." And you've got the whole thing here, all in the hand. And of course, that's the modern handset, isn't it? They had it then. And of course, another thing they were very expert in was they used them an awful lot were very lights and star shells. And they had all colours of the rainbow in these things. And they used them to signal in a way that we never thought of. We used to use a star shell. We'd put up, use a very light pistol and fire a very light, and that was all. But they were experts in the Guy Fawkes stuff. Such as, just don't we know it? They had a high wood when we were on the Somme, when the battery position was our first approach to the Somme. We put our tails down just behind Contalmaison village. High wood had been taken. The high wood ridge had been taken. They were just beyond Mametz, and the Butte de Wallencourt was a thing to sit and look at from the top.